Education Finance Division will come to order, and I know 8:30 sometimes is early, but we will try to get started on time, and so we can maximize the use of the time that we have. We have session at 11, and so in order to get through the agenda for today, we're going to get started. A couple of comments before I turn it over to Shelby and Eric. A number of you have mentioned that your eyes have kind of glazed over, and when it comes to all the formulas and everything. And I do want to reassure you that that happens to all of us when it comes to the complexity of the education finance system that we have. And one of the challenges that I think we should think about is how can we make this financing of our education system a little more simple and straightforward. And yesterday I had the opportunity to visit with the governor for a fair amount of time. And I shared with him, and he shared with me some of his concerns about what he'd like to see in this session and for education in Minnesota. And just a couple of that was one of them, one of the issues we talked about, trying to create a more fair, streamlined education finance system. Another one was there's a growing number of businesses in Minnesota that are finding it more and more difficult to find not so much the college graduates that have degrees and diplomas and everything. That's certainly important and there, but to find the technicians, yeah, the people who run the machines, yeah, and who fix the machines and who are actually the hands-on kinds of people. And one of the things that has happened over the last 10, 15 years is that much of that type of education has kind of washed out of our system, even though we have technical colleges and even though we have intermediate schools and everything. A lot of that has been sacrificed at the expense of an ever-increasing academic standard, and I think probably more important than that, the parental expectation that every child is going to be college graduate and maybe a professional person. And so our visit was about, there's, and I've heard this from several people, about a third of us, and I say us because I'm one of them, learn so much better in kind of the hands-on, traditional, one-to-one kind of approach. And those many of those people, and I think a higher percentage of those students fall into some of the minorities that we have the big gap or the larger gap in trying to figure out how we can address that educational gap. Some of it goes back to that they don't have that tradition. Where their parents have gone to college or their parents have gone through a fairly lengthy educational process. So for this committee, I just want to put that out, that's a concern. It's not just a concern of mine or the governor's. It's a concern that the business community is bringing to the state, and one that I think we should think about how we might be able to reinforce or change that aspect of our education system. So any comments or ideas, I'd be most happy to visit with you. And now we can go back to our the difficult part, Mr. Nauman. One final comment is that the handouts that you gave us, I think for some of us, as our hair gets grayer, it takes more and more light to see that fine print. And last night I was trying to go through and go through those slides. That print is really tiny, I think, anyway.
Mr. Chairman, I fully understand. 10 years ago when a senator would say that to me, I used to scoff at it. And I'm getting more and more conversant with what you're talking about as the years go by. We can go ahead and print these in full pages and hand them out to the committee if that would make matters easier. I see some heads nodding, so we'll go ahead and do that. Our original intent was to give you a snapshot of the slide so that it would offer a refresher and a place to take notes. So we'll have that for you next week.
All right, I think thank that you. Would.
And I should hasten to add that we're also going to have this on the web, so if you want to take a look at it later, that'll be available if your staffs want to do it. I want to thank you for coming back. I'm always amazed that people do come back for the second day when we do this. I think what we'd like to do first is just open it for questions after a quick reminder of what we did yesterday. We talked first about the budget process, some of the timelines of the budget, the constitutional mandate, which I remind you is a nice mooring for your work here. We went through some basic education terms and the education budget, a little reminder about the 2001 reform. We talked about pupil accounting, and then we spent most of our time with the general education formulas. That's where all the numbers were moving, and we had lots of nice graphics and things. So that's where we left off, and we're about to go into the referendum, which I'll warn you does have some formulas in it. And that's probably going to be the worst of the discussion today. And then after that, it gets a little bit easier. So now's a good point. If you have questions that were occurring to you afterwards about the stuff we talked about yesterday, I'll just give you this moment. Of course, you can interrupt any time you want. If I don't see any, I'll proceed into the referendum. Senator Clark, you're smiling. No questions?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nauman, I thought you were being very optimistic that after that brain rush you gave us yesterday that we would have fully formed questions to ask you. But I'm quite sure several of us will be following up when they hit us.
That would be perfectly fine. Well, with that opening, let's move into the referendum now. Referendums, we're talking about the operating referenda now, not capital. And these are where school districts go out to their voters and ask for additional revenue for operating purposes. There is a limit beyond which school districts cannot ask for higher amounts. And under current law, it cannot exceed 26% of the formula allowance. So the mathematicians will say if we add money to the formula, add a buck to the formula, you get 26 cents of additional referendum authority. Some districts can exceed the cap if they had a referendum in place prior to 1994. Sometimes we refer to these as the grandfathered school districts. And I think it was beginning in 2003 we began to offer inflationary adjustments for those districts, so they get to capture some of the inflation that occurs naturally in the economy. Sparsity districts.
Excuse me, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Eric, I think you need to say they had a referendum before 94, but it was also above the cap, wasn't it? It wasn't everybody that had a referendum that.
That's right. Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, I think the way to think about this is in 1993, the legislature established the caps, and it established it at a level that was deemed appropriate by the legislature at that point. Excuse me. And there were some districts that were above that number, and they were held in place up until 2003, at which point we gave them some authority to go out for inflationary adjustments. But some clarification there is probably important. Sparsity districts, again, these are a collection of about 30 districts, fairly small districts, very sparse. They don't have to live within the caps. They can go as high as they want. Most of them don't have any referenda at all, but if they chose to exceed the cap, they could, and some do. There is, depending on a school district's property wealth, some districts, this is an equalized formula on two tiers. Some of the revenue is raised in the form of property tax, and some of it is raised in the form of state aid. So the higher a district's property wealth, this is that aid levy split policy that we talked about in general terms before, but we're going to get into detail in just a moment. The higher a district's property wealth, the more of the referendum is raised by levy, and the converse is true. And again, a reminder, this process is called equalization. Referendum is raised, is determined based on the resident pupil count. Remember, when we talked yesterday, we talked about there were AMCPUs and RMCPUs. RMCPUs are the resident count. Why do we use a resident count? The theory in prior legislatures was that this is a tax that is agreed to by the local voters, and we should use the resident count, kids that live in the district, because there's more locus with the voters that actually have agreed to raise the referendum. Does that make sense? We have a simple formula for this. It's just like the formula allowance. It's an allowance, whatever the voters agree to, times the RMCPUs, and that generates the revenue. There's currently $107.6 million in aid, $484.1 million in levy, and $600 total in revenue.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roblin.
I was just reading that about the portability of aid, the equalization aid. Does it, I mean, portable from district to district?
Mr. Nolan.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, yes. What you're, I think we have some comments about this, but this is a point worth emphasizing here. In the 2000 legislature, the legislature passed a law that allowed the equalized portion, the aid portion, to travel with the student that open enrolls to a charter school or to another school district. So, for example, the example I used yesterday, if I'm a student that lives in Minneapolis and I open enroll into the St. Paul School District, I would take the aid portion that is raised in Minneapolis with me to the St. Paul School District or to a charter school.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Roblin.
Do we know of any cases where that has been a problem of with open enrollment with districts who maybe don't want to accept some students from certain areas because they don't have any of that additional aid coming with them?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, I'm not aware of that specific example. I'm sure, I mean, in the minute I say that I'm not aware of one, somebody will say, yes, it does exist. It probably, I mean, perhaps does. If you hypothetically think about a school district that has most of their referendum raised off the levy as opposed to state aid, there could be some incentives. I'm not saying there are, but there could be some incentives for a school district not to seek those kids to open enroll into their district. I know that there is some competition in some areas where we have declining enrollment. The chairman mentioned yesterday that some school districts are busing from one school district into the other as a way of encouraging open enrollment. So I'm not going to say there aren't incentives. I'm not sure this is the biggest driver. It's not the biggest revenue line because it is only the state aid portion.
Thank Senator you. Olson.
Mr. Chairman and Eric, I think the requirements for open enrollment are such that I don't believe a school district can discriminate on any basis other than whether they have space available. So I don't think they could be selective of saying we want some from districts that will bring some additional aid and not accept them from ones that wouldn't. Isn't their basic decision we'll either accept open enrollment or we won't based on our capacity?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Senator Olson, that's correct. I was perhaps speaking more to the economic incentives and whether that – there could be some encouragement for someone to come or not, and I'm not aware of how that is playing out. But you are correct. In law, that is the way it works.
So, and Mr. Chairman, just clarifying too on your the equalization of referendum, the resident your definition of the resident pupil unit that you're not raising referendum on you said who they are. It's on the resident members. That means that students that open enroll into that district aren't counted then in the number that is a basis for an operating referendum.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, that's correct. Okay. Just to reiterate that point, an open enrolled student would not count for the district's, under my example, I would not generate referendum revenue in the St. Paul School District. I would generate referendum revenue in the Minneapolis District. And then going to Senator Roebling's point, I would pull the state aid portion with me to St. Paul.
Okay, so, but Mr. Chairman, you are counted in the district you live in.
I would be counted.
Even if you're not attending there.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, that's correct.
Okay.
Okay. Mr. Nauman?
Okay, so Mr. Chairman, this is the point where we go into equalization. In more detail than we have before. We sort of talked about it in general terms, but I thought some good examples would be helpful. On the referendum specifically, the first 600, and under the current fiscal year, it's now increased to 700. I realize that we didn't update that, but of approved referendum is equalized at what we call an equalizing factor of $476,000. And going to Senator Salzman's question to me yesterday about whether these are whether the equalizing factors have been adjusted, this is the number that has not been adjusted. Then the next $694, or the difference between the cap, the hard cap, and that first equalization level per pupil unit is equalized at a lower $270,000. As I mentioned, there's an exception. Sparsity school districts qualify for the full equalization on all referendum revenue. So the process is, again, we have a hypothetical example. Again, 2,000 pupil units, and that big $250 million number represents the referendum market value of this hypothetical district. So if that district asks the voters to approve $750 per pupil of referendum revenue, and the voters approve, we know the following. The revenue is going to be $1.5 million. So that's the simple calculation of getting the total revenue. Does that make sense? Then if we move forward, we're now going to calculate the aid and levy. And the first thing we do is divide the referendum market value by the pupil count, or the pupil unit count. So we get $125,000 of referendum market value per pupil in this school district. Make sense? And then we will work through both the first tier and the second tier of equalization. We multiply 600, that's our the first equalization tier, times the pupil count, and we know that of that 1.5 million of revenue in this school district off the referendum, 1.2 million of it is coming on the first tier. The second tier is going to be the difference between the approved referendum, the 750, and that first tier level of 600. So we're left with 150. We multiply that times the pupil count, and we get the remaining 300. The mathematicians will say, well, Eric, couldn't you just have subtracted 1.2 from 1.5? And the answer is, of course, but I just wanted to take you through the steps. Now we have a first-tier levy and a second-tier levy calculation. And we take the first-tier revenue and multiply it times our referendum market value per pupil in this district and divide that over the equalizing factor. And then we do the same thing for the second-tier revenue over the other equalizing factor on the second tier. And so now we know what the levy on the first tier and what the levy on the second tier is, $315,000, $138,000. Obviously, we add them together and we get the total levy. And what's the rule? The aid is equal to the revenue minus the levy.
So if we do that,
we now have $1 million of aid. And then you can calculate a simple percentage. We have 30.3% levy and 69.7% aid in that school district.
Excuse me, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Eric, could you print out that example, including a little narrative, just as a rule of thumb? I think that is one of the harder concepts to explain to somebody. And I think some of us, even us veterans, could use some assist in thinking that through to be sure that we can explain it to somebody.
Certainly.
Particularly, you know, when we're dealing with property tax issues these days, I think that needs to be understood.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
If you could do that in a kind of the for simple folks like us to be able to understand, and I'm sorry to cast any aspersions on any of my colleagues, but I think we probably could all use a little help. That's not one of the easier parts of our whole complex system.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, no. It's one of the more complex systems that we have.
Because,
so.
Mr. Chairman, we do, you know, we talk about equalizing. And we understand that means that there's kind of a relative share. But just to have that, I know that when you use that in other circles, eyes glaze over. And it would be helpful for some to simply be able to explain it.
I'm sorry.
Senator Salzman.
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing on this form, I mean, it is extremely complex, but I think it's important to note that when you see districts, some getting more aid or levy than others, people who live in similarly valued homes are making the same effort. And that's, I think, where we have sometimes discussion of they're getting more aid than us or we're having to pay more. It's that if you live in a similarly valued home, that homeowner or that business is still making the same effort. And through the equalization, we're not asking some communities to pay two or three times as much to fund their schools. And that's where I believe that the equity, where we can find common ground, but it also is something that I think that sometimes is misunderstood. That's just a statement from me. I'm not asking for clarification. But I think that that's where I think when we look at school districts that have lower property wealth, they're not getting away with paying less. Sometimes they're often paying more on their operating levy because it's not fully equalized.
I was going to just go to the equal or to the inflation, the 476 on the first tier.
Mm-hmm.
The year that was put in place, I'm not sure what year was that.
Mr. Chairman, that was 1993.
Between 93 and now, there's been a huge increase in the inflation. And so I remember, I think it was last 2 years ago maybe, when Mr. Melcher from the department showed the state's effort in aid that was put in going on a reverse graph. It was going down as the local share was going up. What would that number be if you had adjusted it for inflation?
Mr. Chairman and members, I'd have to do a few calculations on that. You begin in 93 and you make adjustments all the way up. I know that this committee, for each year, and I don't at the tip of my fingertips know the exact calculations to make right here. We'd have to do a little research, but okay. We could certainly do that. This committee considered an adjustment to this equalizing factor last year. I think there were two bills before it, and we did include, I guess we didn't include it in the final bill, but there was equalizing factor adjustments in the final bill. We went to 750 in two bills that were considered before this committee last year.
Senator Rowland, do you have a...
Well, just a comment. I appreciate that we have some equity as far as homes, but there is also an inequity built into that system in that similarly valued and similar homes are two different things according to where you are geographically in the state too. A home like in St. Paul now, where the values have appreciated on the older homes significantly, would be valued a lot less, and maybe in one of the small towns in your district.
You know, we get into this whole concept of valuation and everything. One of the concepts that I think we'll hear about next week in that from a report from PS Minnesota is a cost of living kind of a concept. Different people have talked to me about, well, from other parts or greater Minnesota, is the value of your home what you can actually sell it for, or what kind of there's a big debate about it. I mean, you can have the same home, let's say if it was exactly identical, and it would be worth maybe 150% more down here than it would be in some other place, and yet it's an identical home. And so, I mean, it's, but the geographic difference would be that you can't get any more for it than what you can actually sell it for. So it's a, I know we went through this debate for umpteen years on the value of farmland. Mm-hmm. How do you value farmland? In fact, that actually led to taking the farmland off of the referendum. For about 2-3 years, I had carried legislation to try to tie the value of farmland to the actual rent, a percentage of the rent that farmers pay in that given area. And it is just a quagmire of, I mean, trying to figure out valuations. I think they've gotten better, but now we see a reverse in the real estate market, and you'll, I'm sure, here in a few years, if that continues, where real estate goes down, you'll hear a host of calls from your constituents saying, you know, my property taxes are going up, but yet the valuations are going down. What's going on? And quite often, there's a number of things that can trigger it. One, in case of farmland, is that, well, there might not be any sales in your district to value, so they hold the values up. So they don't, I mean, there's the system of valuation, there's the method of valuation, but I do think it is better than it used to be. It used to be, I mean, we'd have huge, huge disparities, but I think it's gotten somewhat better. Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think in education, because we still, in spite of the state taking over much of the funding, we still do have that strong connection through operating referendum with the property tax that, and I'm sorry that we've made the total disconnect from people who serve on education funding of not being able to be on taxes because we're a budget division. Mm-hmm. And that often was the closer relationship. But the property tax, I have... I've gotten, you know, absolutely radical on it, and I've kind of backed off because it's a hard battle to fight. But the taxing of an asset that is not liquid, I mean, you can't take a corner off and go and pay your taxes with it. And many people, when that value has gotten high, they have, and people have lived in their homes or had the property for a long time, they have bought that property time and time again through property taxes, and it's so you add the income, may not, the income disparity might be there, and I see that in my area where we've got extremely high valued land as the lots along Lake Minnetonka become scarce, and you can drive along there and you'll see these humble little ramblers or little cottage like that have been winterized and people have lived in it and now they've retired and they still like to enjoy their little piece of heaven on Lake Minnetonka, and their taxes are just exorbitant and they can't afford it. And so we say, well, but you know, they've got this quote wealth, but it's not, you have to sell it in order to get it. So, you know, should we, you know, I struggle with, should we be having a policy, a form of taxation that essentially forces those kinds of decisions on people just by virtue of that asset? And, you know, we could envy, I mean, my aunt and uncle lived in Trimont, Minnesota, and when they passed away, he'd been the banker in town, and they had a, you know, it was not an older home, but beautiful, lovely, lovely home with fireplaces and, you know, gorgeous den in between that opened up to their bedroom and all this stuff. And when that went on auction, I think it was 20, that was just a few years ago now, 29,000 I think it went for, on a corner lot across from a park on the main drag. If you took that element and put it in a suburban area, or places where it would have had a whole different value. So it's still, you know, who lives there and what they earn is still a factor. And I have great sympathy for, you know, this particular seniors group to say we need to get it based, more of our taxation based on ability to pay than on the property tax, which is why I've had a constitutional amendment, and at least I got hearing 1 year of letting people decide whether they want an ad valorem tax anymore, a value-based tax. And, you know, I try to get people to argue with me and say, now, why would this not be a good idea? And I can't get people to argue with me. I have one, Keith Carlson, he made one statement to me finally after used to be the aide to Senator Dean, Doug Johnson, a longtime tax committee chair. And he said, I would never support anything that would automatically increase the value of something. And I mean, I've still been trying to grapple with that if we didn't tax on that basis, that it would elevate the value, so that I suppose it would motivate people to try to, you know, stock up. Would we start concentrating property in the hands of, I don't know. I love to debate these things, and I wish so. I'm sorry to take time in doing this, but I'm trying to stimulate some thought on this subject. Is the property tax a good idea? Because we were working on, yes, you need to fund local government, but is the value of the property, or is there some other connection? Every piece of property, especially if there's people living there, benefits from those local services. And you notice how all the cities are pushing and giving more unit-based stuff. They want unit-based street utility. We're getting bills now street quarterly base to cover our solid, you know, recycling pickup and stormwater management. And you know, there's different ways that we're trying to get away from it, and we're adding. It's a mixed up mess, and I really hope that the people that are on tax committee rather than finance, if any of you are there, will really do some digging into it. And those of us on the outside certainly have a right to agitate in that direction. If you will.
Mr. Nauman, out in California, they have tried to tackle the that inflation. Proper real estate inflation in a different way, and how did they do it out there?
Mr. Chairman, are you thinking about Proposition 13?
No, I was thinking about freezing. They don't actually reevaluate the full value of that property until it actually is sold.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's some of the effects of Proposition 13, which was passed by the voters in 1978. I grew up in California, so I can speak a little bit about it. What happens in California is that a home, and I forget the exact numbers, but a home that was owned in 1972 had its property taxes reassessed back down to that level in 1978. And then there was only a certain percentage of growth allowed until the home was then sold, at which point it snaps back. In my parents' situation, where they're retired and they've held the same home since about that same time frame, there is a drastic disparity between the property taxes that my parents pay and what has happened across the street where their new neighbors have moved in. There's a thousands and thousands of dollars difference, and I think there's some arguments about equity issues associated with that. My parents are retired, and they are now in a circumstance where they'd like to buy a smaller house. My brother and I have left and no longer live there, but they believe they can't afford to do that, so they're knocking around this big house, and they have no one to help take care of it because their son lives in Minnesota.
I don't want to prolong this. I would just say to Senator Olson, because share your frustration with the system, too. The big problem with the property tax, of course, is it's the most stable. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I put problem in quotes there. That's the frustration. And so I like the idea of relating it to services received, and frankly, because the more expensive homes in my community don't really get a whole lot more service or any more service than some of the less expensive homes. And so if we could make it, not only would it be, well, it would be stabilized, it would be stabilized for people in a community as well. So that's the problem. I mean, where do we go? And, of course, the inequity that's happened in California because of Prop 13 is a terrible thing. You don't want young families coming in and having to bear the brunt of these taxes that have snapped right up to today's value. Yeah, it's a real issue.
Just what little Senator Olson, that's the challenge of any action you take has consequences, and trying to think that through. On the one hand, you can see that the people buying homes, you know, people are paying on a value that's closely related to what they paid for it and what they were capable of doing at that time, and it takes away that that market-driven kind of stuff from it. But for those who are buying today, there's an assumption that they have the income that would support buying at that price. But the reality is that, as Senator Anderson was just saying, the people don't want to sell because they don't want to move on to do anything because they are protected by it. So sure. you don't have as much property available. Therefore, it drives up the value of others, making it more difficult to do it. There are challenges in it, and that's why a value-based tax, you know, inherently, given our times in comparison with when our country was founded and land was, it was, I think, fairly equal in value across the country, and it seemed like a pretty easy way to, in a stable way to assess a tax, it's not the same now. So I hope we can at least, you know, I don't know whether there is an answer, but if there is, I hope that we could put our heads together and come up with something that's better than what we're doing now.
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chairman, this sounds like the Tax Committee. Are there other questions on the operating referendum before we move on? It gets a little bit simpler from here on out until we get to the special ed section.
At least you warn us.
Okay. As part of general education, there are a couple of final points that we wanted to highlight, and they are the learning and development reserve. There's a few reserves and a penalty that we want to highlight. Reserve revenue for staff development, operating capital, and telecommunications access, and then finally a contract settlement penalty. The learning and development reserve is part of general education. School districts are required under law to reserve part of their general education revenue to reduce or maintain class sizes at a ratio of 17-1. Members will recall when we spoke about some of the pupil weights that I made reference to the fact that that extra increment was in part designed to do class size reduction. And the second piece of that increased weight is this change. In fiscal 2005, it was about $160, and it's gone up a little since then.
Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Nauman, I know that many of our school districts, in fact, don't have those ratios, and that's complaints that we hear all the time. So I wonder how that works and what the enforcement is and what's not working about that formula that has allowed in those grades the class size to go much beyond that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, this is an important question. Governor Ventura used to talk about this when he brought this up in 99. He said, I want to be able to walk into a classroom and see 17 kids to one teacher. Some of this is definitional. Teachers' aides are sometimes allowed to change the to count towards the ratio. But in most cases, school districts will say to you that state aid has not kept up with inflation, and that is why they've had to add students to class sizes. Other districts have passed referenda on the backs of and sold it to their voters based on this will help us keep class size reduction down. Minneapolis is the case that immediately slips to my mind. They had a referendum in 99, I believe, that was sold to the voters on that basis. But they would also argue that inflation has had its effect, and they haven't been able to keep their class sizes at the ratios that were originally promised.
Mr. Nauman, does a district that does not have the 17-to-1 ratio, how does that impact the $160? Not the $160, but impact the state aid?
Mr. Chairman, there is a requirement that school districts meet these class size ratios in grades K to 3. And in most cases, I think it's fair to say that school districts attempt to meet those ratios. There is not a penalty if they don't.
Okay. Thank you.
But the money has to be used first for that purpose.
Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nelman, I would assert that at this point it's probably way less than you might think that do meet that, and I would be very interested in having a survey of that so we can actually understand what the class size is. Is that something that would be possible?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, we can attempt it. Sometimes the data isn't always as good as we'd like, but we'll certainly pursue it. If I don't write it down, I will forget. There's also a reserve for staff development. School districts are required to reserve 2% of their basic formula allowance, about 92% for staff development. Districts may opt out of this requirement, however. This used to be a harder requirement a few years back if the majority of the school board and the teachers vote to bypass that requirement.
Or if the district statute.
Finally, contract settlement deadline. You may receive some conversation about this year. Usually every couple of years, this does tend to get some conversation in this committee. If a school district and its teachers fail to reach settlement by the deadline of January 15th, and that would be of next year, then there is a $25 penalty per pupil on the school district, and the department will recapture some of the aid. There have been years when this has been set aside legislatively, 2001, 2002 notably, and the fiscal 03 year was another example. So I guess the way to think about this, the last couple of budgets, we have set this requirement aside. And that does carry a cost when we do that, because we make assumptions in the forecasting process that this, on average, will cost about $150,000 statewide. So if you sunset that penalty, it does generate a cost to the state.
Is this special ed now?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nauman, do we have any that means that people haven't been settling, so we're not paying the $25, but do we have much of a track record of the ultimate settlements, if they are moderated by that, or what's the behavior there, and what are the consequences of that in relation to the, quote, cuts that end up having to be done versus letting people
Mr.
be free?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, that's kind of a complicated question. I'll do my best to get at it. What I can tell you is $150,000 on a statewide basis is assumed in the forecast for the next two budget years, and that is exactly what we assumed in the previous couple of forecasts. I haven't done any direct work on why $150,000 is the number, but I can tell you that $150,000 on a statewide basis suggests that the department believes there would be very few districts that would actually be subjected to this penalty. So it's not a large number. We could have a conversation about what sort of incentives we think this might impose, but $25 is not an insignificant number on a per pupil basis. Either. So I'm sort of at a loss to describe what I think the incentives would be.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nolan, I wasn't expecting, it was kind of rhetorical, but yet it would be interesting to know whether that policy drives higher settlements by January 15th, or whether it has any effect on what those settlements are, even though the district loses revenue if they have to settle afterwards. I don't if there's maybe the School Board Association has
yes.
some
Mr. Chairman,
on that.
Senator Olson, I think it depends on who you talk to. If you talk to Education Minnesota, they say that the law speeds up more settlements and they get them done, and that when you don't have that law in place, then there's more settlements, more districts that haven't negotiated an agreement. The School Board Association will say that it forces the a higher settlement cost, you know, in the negotiating because they don't want to, you know, they feel a little pressure for getting that settled. So,
well, Mr. Chairman, that's my question. It's yes, the number of settlements is one thing, but the costs are what drives the challenges that we face. And you know, what, I'm not suggesting that you know what's good or bad, but it would be interesting to see what. Mm-hmm. What the outcome is of that policy, not just in timing and getting it settled so that people can get on with life, which is a positive, but what those amounts are and what the consequences of that is in terms of how the district has to manage their resources.
It seems to me that on visiting with districts and educators that the bigger factor is what's actually happening in your area, you know, when one district will make a settlement, if it's a suburban district, then you can be pretty sure that there's going to be more that are it's kind of like the state negotiations, you know, the first contract that goes down the pike and gets settled kind of sets the tone for the rest of them. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the individual districts. I had a district that lost money a couple years ago on this, and the district was in financial had some financial problems, and so the board just decided that they were going to hold tight, and they did lose the money. So it's you know a couple of those factors I think that drive it more than this is
then,
a.
What, Mr. Chairman, but then what was the final settlement?
Well, I don't know who actually won and what the exact percentage was, but I'm guessing I don't know. I guess they both say they didn't fare well. So, but this comes to what 6,000 students, roughly. The aid. Well, if it was strictly aid, it would be that, so.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, roughly, I think so.
It is
so we make that assumption.
It's on the formula, and we're paying that.
So it's not a large number.
How do you measure what it would have been otherwise? It's hard to tell. You can look at the bottom.
Yeah, positions. Mr. Chairman, that's exactly right.
Yes.
Okay, so, Mr. Chairman, I think this is a good point to begin crawling into the special ed lines of the budget, and I would like to turn to my colleague Shelby McQuay to continue the briefing at this point.
Ms. McQuay.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll briefly go over some of the details associated with the special education, and then I'll pass it back to Mr. Nauman to talk about more of the fiscal policy associated with special education. If you look again at your spreadsheet that was passed out yesterday, these numbers are from that spreadsheet. In fiscal year 06, the total state aid spent on special education was $678.1 million. The way the state pays for special education to districts is by calculating the percentage of revenue that's generated for the special education students over and above what's generated for the general education. So it's 68% of the salaries and 52% of the contracted cost. These are the costs that are supplementary to the general education, and then 47% of supplies and equipment.
Just to jump in here, is that a capped appropriation?
Mr. Chair, yes, the special education revenue is capped and then prorated to districts.
So in reality, what's in statute, like the 68%, may not be 68% to an individual district.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And okay. When we, when Mr. Nauman talks about this a little more in detail, he'll go into the disparities with special education.
Okay, thank you.
Revenue and expenditures.
Senator Wergen and then Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McQuaid, I had a question about the 52% of contracted costs. I've never been real clear what's all contained in contracted costs. Can you give me some?
You get the statute.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wergen.
Okay, we'll have Eric or Mr. Nauman get the actual language. Senator Wergen?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's actually part of my problem is that I'm hearing from schools that what's in law isn't necessarily what's being adhered to for contracted costs. So that's kind of why I'm wondering what's going on with that one.
Okay, good question. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I can't remember which of the meetings that we've been at where this was a point that at one point, and it's still within my memory, we didn't cap the appropriation and prorate it. We essentially, when we came back the following year, if there were some resources available, we, you know, took, that was one of the first bills that passed that funded that, you know, brought, so that we were honoring our formula and filled that in. We may have run out in that given biennium, but what's the term you called?
Deficiency appropriation.
What?
Deficiency appropriation.
Yeah, fund the deficiency out of reserves before we start spending it somewhere else. And do you know what year we abandoned that notion?
Maybe Mr. Nauman can
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I always have to turn to Mr. Nauman for a more historical perspective.
They're working on it back here, so.
Add that to the list.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, what my gut tells me it was in the 99 time frame. I don't recall ever passing one of those bills. I'm aware that we used to during my tenure. Hmm. But what I can tell you is that in the 1999 bill, we established a program growth factor, which escalated special education expenses, or not expenses, the state aid paid towards towards both the regular and the excess cost special education. The regular grew at 4.6% and the excess grew at 2%, and that had the effect of negating the need for it because we were always ahead of the game. We were adding dollars every year, so the cap never came into play and we were actually increasing our costs or expenditures rather.
This actually is a very important and big item because it amounts to, what did you say, close to $700 million?
Mr. Chairman, if I can ask members to hold on this discussion, we've got a few charts that may be some good food for thought as we get into that.
Ms. McQuaid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just quickly go over the other programs that feed into the special education revenue that are supplementary to the straight revenue. The state also provides a revenue source for excess cost, and these are the costs to the district that are over and excess cost aid goes out to districts whose unreimbursed special education costs are over 4.36% of the district's general education revenue. In this amount is also capped and prorated to districts. And then the 2005 legislature slightly changed the definition of the general education revenue by slowly subtracting out the referendum revenue, and that effective 2008, the general education revenue will no longer include referendum revenue as part of this calculation.
What happened?
Maybe repeat that.
Okay. The special education costs, when you're calculating excess cost aid, excess cost aid goes out to districts whose unreimbursed special education costs are over 4.36% of the general education revenue. General education revenue is currently calculated at, that includes the referendum revenue. So by 2008, we'll no longer include referendum revenue as part of the general education revenue. So it will look, there were a lot of districts that were being perceived to have a lot more general education revenue because of a high referendum. Mm-hmm. And once this is subtracted from the general education revenue, they'll be more in line with the other districts who do not have as much referendum revenue.
This was a concession to the wealthier western suburbs. No.
I'll watch it.
Actually, I have one district that's has the highest referendums in the state of Minnesota. So. Senator Monoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. McQuay. This is very interesting because it does probably affect my districts in a big way, in that I know that they have significant amount of excess costs in special ed, but they probably have been limited in their excess cost aid by the amount of referendum that they get compared to their general ed. So then my question is, how is it prorated? How is it I would think all of our districts have excess of 4.36. How do we decide who gets what? Can you just speak a little about that?
Who do we want to?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonner, perhaps I'll try to tackle that one. Not every school district does qualify for excess cost aid. The idea here is that this is for overburdens, increased special, higher than normal special ed costs, if you can visualize a normal cost. The calculation change that we made to exclude the referendum was under the logic that just because a school district has passed a referendum for itself shouldn't dictate how much special ed revenue that it receives. And there's arguments on both sides. Have I answered your question or not?
Mr. Chairman, my question, though, is with the money that you do hand out to districts, how, when you say you prorate it, you prorate it equally among the number of districts that qualify? Is that how it's calculated?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonoff, I know why I didn't answer your question. I was trying to hold off on the proration discussion until we get into some of the charts that will make some of that. But the answer is yes, it's prorated down all districts in, that's what a proration is. It goes down equally so that all districts, if we don't have enough money to spend to fill the need, all districts will get, say, 91% of the need.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, just a quick clarification on this. I'm trying to wrap my mind around this, too, and why some districts would feel this harms them. But some districts are relying more on operating referendum, and therefore the hurdle that they have to reach in order to qualify for excess costs is higher than the regular basic formula, because some districts do have other mechanisms within our funding that qualify, that elevate their amount, that it's not operating referendum.
What I was curious
is to the you said that no longer will referendum revenue be included in general education revenue. By definition, totally or only for the purposes of calculating excess costs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, general education as defined for excess cost aid.
Okay, thank you.
Would we need to have excess cost aid if we actually did not have a capped appropriation for special ed revenues?
Mr. Chairman and members, need is a speculative question. You could choose not to, of course. But the reason that the special education formula was put into place was so that those districts that had high incidences of special education costs, it was a more efficient way of targeting revenue to state aid for special ed needs to those districts, as opposed to filling the entire regular education pot up to much higher levels. It was a more efficient way of targeting the dollars.
True, but if you see special education as a federal mandate, court requirement, something that we have a responsibility, you know, at least for more or less of funding it, wouldn't it be better to just fully fund the special education costs at the statutorily designated amounts, the 68%, the 52%, and the 47%, and then not do the excess?
Mr. Chairman, I know that still would not fully deal with the high incidence needs of some districts that are experiencing higher costs. 68% of a bigger number still leaves what some districts would argue would be a larger hole.
Mr. Chair.
And maybe you could, do you have a list of those districts in that excess cost aid category?
Mr. Chairman, we can certainly prepare a list. Having done this discussion a few times, it's my sense that we are maybe putting the cart before the horse. Sure. Let's get through the programs, and then let's talk. It would be my recommendation for us to then talk about the notions of how those caps work, how the proration works, and that's what we'd like to have you do.
Right. So I see more hands up.
That's what I was afraid of, Mr. Chairman.
I know we'll come back and visit this many times before. Senator Wergen was first, and then Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But there's two problems that we don't talk about very often, and they both are factual in that Minnesota has far more requirements for special education than the federal government. As a state, we've chosen to go way beyond federal requirements, which does create some problems. Even school districts are finding it very, very hard to meet the state demands and the way they're being interpreted in law. So in law, we have some things that school districts are feeling are impossible to meet without incredible costs that they really can't control. And the second piece is special ed is one of the things that I don't think we fund very rationally. It has to be funded, and it has to be well funded, but it's not very rationally funded because we just if you take nursing homes or anything like that, we have, can't think of the right word, categories, you know, the A through K ratings of clients and stuff like that. But we have none of that stuff in special education. We just kind of have this hodgepodge of throwing money out there. Really, that's determined by nobody except, well, here's what it costs. And one of the huge problems that's being caused is that when special ed students open enroll to another district, the district that they open enroll to is billing back to the district that the student actually is a resident in, and there's no control of the cost that that district is putting into the student. So we have some special ed programs that are, I'll put it that way, somewhat excessive, and others that are kind of having a really hard time just all in the way we allow the billing and the way we allow special ed to be handled. So I think we bear a great deal of responsibility in changing the way we do special ed.
Senator Anderson.
Well, now I have three questions. and I don't care if you want to answer them now or answer them later. I just want to get them on the table.
Exactly.
And first goes to, because Senator Wergen triggered a question in my mind, and that is because Wes Scoglin used to sit next to me, and he always talked about some of these very, very difficult, really violent kids that he dealt with that would cost a district, you know, multiple tens of thousands of dollars a year to handle effectively one-on-one and in special rooms that had protection to keep everyone safe. And there is such a range of needs within special education and the costs that go with that. And I don't know, I'm very curious to learn more about whether any of these funding factors, and I think Senator Wergen was getting at this, really take that range of need into account, and that's something we might want to take a look at. And now, if I can remember my other two questions. Oh, one is about the prorating, and I just wondering, of that 68%, for example, and those other percentages, how much, what percent are we actually at right now? And you can get to that later if you want to when you talk about prorating. And my third question is, so even if we got to, you know, how far would it take us just to get to 68%, much less is there a need that's for more than that? I don't know. The third question is trying to remember in 2003 what we did in the cut. I don't think you've mentioned that. And I thought we eliminated the growth factor. Is it something? Can you just refresh our memories about what happened there?
Mr. Chairman and members, I promise the proration will get clearer once we go through the chart, so I'll leave that one. What we did in the 2003 budget was turn off the program growth factors. We used to have what the governor at the time, current governor, referred to as cost escalators, that we would add dollars every year. And in regular special ed, it was 4.6% was added every year. This was a legislative change that was added to the special ed formulas in the 1999 timeframe. And excess costs grew at 2% a year. So every year we would move forward and we would adjust the state appropriations upward by either 4.6% and 2%. And understanding how we budget here, by turning those growth factors off, school districts did not receive any fewer dollars as a result of that, but they stayed at roughly the same level, which is why last year we began to bump into some of the problems of maintaining the effort, because if we're roughly at the same point and pupils are declining under the federal law, which says you can't have fewer dollars year to year, we actually had to make some upward adjustments to the excess cost formula to ensure that we were maintaining the effort and didn't receive a federal penalty.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, just two areas kind of along this line to put on the table for that larger discussion. Some of you are and some of you aren't on the policy committee, and we had the discussion of a resolution to Congress asking for more money. And I believe it was a school board member from St. Cloud that made a case that I have heard from many of my superintendents that oftentimes the amount of referendum revenue that's being asked in increase is essentially correlates directly with the amount of cross subsidy for special ed that's required, and many of them are hesitant to use that because they don't want to stir a backlash or create the notion that somehow we're against funding special ed. But I think that is a critical point. But there's also another hidden motivation there when you bring up the issue of the maintenance of effort, because that's been a concern, is that if we increase our funding, we're locked into a maintenance of effort, and that no matter if the federal government increased their percentage, it wouldn't reduce the cross subsidy. It means we'd have to spend more. And so I would like to, we need to, a little more discussion along that line, if that has been part of what's driven us to instead of doing the funding at the state level, of protecting ourselves by forcing it to be a cross subsidy at the local level, which is not affected, which does not drive the maintenance of effort, is my understanding. Could just rather than elaborate now, see if we couldn't deal with that issue a little more when we come back to it.
Mr. Chairman, Allen. Senator Olson, I was tracking with you up until the last two sentences. Maybe you can rephrase that for me.
I think she said that we're going to come back. Think about it, and we're going to come back.
I'll talk to you after this.
Okay.
Again.
No,
that's a good question.
Mr. Chair and members, the next few programs I'm going to talk about are our other revenue sources for districts who have pupils that are not generating money under the regular special education revenue. Transition disabled revenue is for those students who are in career and technical programs with, and they have disabilities. The formula is also capped and may be prorated to the districts if the total statewide amount exceeds it. Special education pupil aid is for students that are not residents of the district but are being served because they have their foster facilities or care and treatment facilities in that district. Home-based travel aid is for not necessarily students, but for the professionals who travel to the homes to provide home-based services to children with disabilities who are under the age of five. And the districts are reimbursed 50% of the travel costs for those personnel. Other special education programs include the court-placed special education revenue. These are out-of-state students who come into the state and are served in the state where the home district in the other state is not reimbursing the district in Minnesota. So this provides a revenue stream for that. Out-of-state tuition for the special education students is the opposite. It's students from Minnesota who are going out-of-state for care and treatment facilities or the like and are being served in other states that we are reimbursing those states for. The legislature repealed the section allowing districts to receive state aid to pay for special education litigation and hearing costs. And that was, in 2003, that was about 16 districts. And we'll move on from here with Mr. Nauman talking about the discrepancy between the special education expenditures and revenues.
Okay, this is what you wanted. This is the first time we've tried this discussion out, so I will be interested in your feedback about whether it works and whether we can make some changes. Obviously, we need to move it up further in the briefing because some of the conversation earlier, we found, obviously, this would have been helpful a little bit earlier in the discussion. The top line represents school districts, and I want to credit Mr. Melcher at the department for providing us some of these charts. He's used it at some of the briefings of special ed local officials, and when I called him with questions about his advice on the best way to do this, he said, well, Eric, I've got these charts. Why don't you just steal them? And I said, well, I'm not above plagiarism, so I'm just going to do that. The top line.
Right.
It's sourced, so I suppose it's okay. The top line represents over time since 1999 the school district's expenditures on special education, what they're actually spending. The line below represents how much the districts are receiving from the state in special education. Now, as we talked about in response to Senator Anderson's question earlier, we did turn off the program growth factors, and that's why the line flattens out and the cross-subsidy has been growing. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this chart just plots the special education cross-subsidy. And I should add, and we'll pass out a document that there are a couple of definitions of the special education cross-subsidy. This is the larger number. This represents this number represents line C on the chart that's going to be handed out to you over time, as well as the projections that are going forward. Mm-hmm. And this definition most closely correlates with our tuition billing statute that was passed a couple of years ago, and the department believes that this represents the legislative blessing on which definition we should use. But there are legitimate arguments on which definition, and it relates to how much time a student spends in regular education classroom and adjusting for that. If you make a different adjustment, this line would be slightly lower, but the trend would be exactly the same.
Thank you.
Cross-subsidy is due in part to the statutory funding caps, which the funding caps relate materially to Senator Anderson's point that we turned off the growth factors. And those caps exist on both the regular special ed as well as the excess cost aid. The statewide adjustment factor.
Senator Bonoff.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nauman, does it also relate to the fact that we aren't appropriating to the cap?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff, we are appropriating to the cap. That is the definition of the cap, what we appropriate versus what the percentages that Ms. McQuay talked about earlier, and actually that ties directly into this point, but I want to make sure that made sense.
So we are appropriating 68%, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonner, maybe we should define the terms here. What I mean by the cap is the amount that we are actually appropriating versus what we would appropriate if we were just dealing with that one percentage, the 68%, if we were actually appropriating up to the 68% level. The difference between those two is what we call the statewide adjustment factor, and that's what we're just talking about here. And so if you divide the statutory funding level to the state total adjusted base revenue, these are a lot of terms here, but think about it as the 68% number divided by what we're actually appropriating. That gives you a ratio. And in for 2007, the regular special ed ratio was the $528 million cap. That's what we were appropriating versus the $665, which was the 68%. And that's a 79%, what some people call a proration.
Thank you.
Does that help?
Yes.
So we were actually short somewhat over 100 and, what, 40-some million?
Mr. Chairman, that's roughly correct. It gets more complicated.
So Mr. Chairman, it just occurred to me, are we playing the same game that the feds are in that we've authorized a certain level and then we are appropriating at a different level and then we mess around with some of these terms to confuse people? that we really aren't trying to do that?
Mr. Chairman,
I think reality is pretty real.
I think that's
the
best leading question I've heard today.
That's the best leading question I've heard all day.
Mr. Chairman, I think maybe the pot is calling the kettle black.
Well, I think there are some interesting trends that result from some of the choices that we made in 2003, and that's what these next few charts are designed to show, is the implications, not passing judgment on them, but just what is happening factually. And so we've got that concept of that ratio, right, because it does dictate to some of these next charts. So if you apply those ratios over time, these are what we're projecting. So the regular special ed represents that sort of maroon bar, 88% proration, 84, 79, which was the one that we referenced on the previous slide, 76, 72. You can see the trends kind of go in the wrong direction. And excess cost, you're showing the same trend. So is that helpful?
If you had one more bar up there.
Leave it up there.
If that bar up there, put another bar on the left side of the maroon bar, that would actually represent the 68%. Where would that bar be going up?
Well, I think the way to think about this is that the regular special ed is the maroon bar, and that's where the 68% applies. And just to simplify this dramatically, 88% on the 2005 number, we're spending under this logic, which is not entirely perfect, and we'll get into that in a second. We're spending 88% of the 68%.
The question that I was trying to get at is that the overall total special ed cost to all districts is going up.
Mr. Chairman.
And your maroon bars are going down.
His chart, 100% is 68%, right?
Right. If you took that top line there.
You can see the projections.
Right.
The top line represents the actual education expenditures.
68%.
For the, no, that's what they're totally spending. And think about special education as a federal, state, and local partnership of which these are the dollars that are getting spent. So some of those dollars are raised locally by school districts or provided by us. At the state level, some of them are paid as a special education categorical, and that's the line represented there, and there's federal dollars also. So that's why when we calculate the special education cross subsidy, it's not going to tie directly between the difference between those two numbers, because there's some other revenue streams. And the legislature in years past has spoken and said, we're not going to pay for 100% of the salaries, we're going to spend 68%. but the trend is going upwards.
Senator Culp.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nauman, the numbers that you're giving us are regular special aid, and we were about $140 million shy from the 68% that we have statutorily dedicated. What do we spend in excess cost aid? Or was that included in the regular special aid numbers that you'd give us?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Koch, you're anticipating where I'm going.
Okay.
Because the $140 million is done under a strict analysis of that proration. That's what this shows us. But to move to the next step, there's a huge amount of interaction between regular special ed and excess cost special ed. And the statewide adjustment factors that we sometimes call proration create a misleading picture of the overall impact of the caps, and here's why. A reduction in special education regular aid, once you hit the cap on that, due to the statewide cap, actually increases the gross excess cost aid, which then in turn has an effect on the reduces the adjustment factor for the excess cost aid. So if you're pulling down regular, you're actually creating larger proration on excess cost. So it's misleading. That 39% on the excess cost, some of that's due to interactions. So we've come up with another way to measure it. And that's a more accurate way to assess the overall value of the caps would be to compare the total capped aid to the sum of what the total special education regular and excess cost aid would be without any caps. And I think, Senator Koch, this might have been where you were headed. Does that make sense? I'm trying to take you through some steps. And if you do that, in 2005, we were meeting 91% of the need, and the projections go down to about 74% of the need based on forecasted appropriations. And I should say these are dated a little bit, but the trend is the same. This was for the February 06 forecast. Tom hasn't had a chance to adjust them yet. And in terms of real dollars, and these are millions, we were $61 million short, not $140. $61 million short, $95 million, and going up to $218. The trend is the same, but the magnitude is not quite as great. And that's kind of where I end this discussion. I hope it was helpful.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Nauman. I apologize. You may have answered this question. I missed the first bit on the special ed. But and I'm looking in the information, and I don't see it. Do you have the enrollment numbers and what the trends have been for special ed enrollment and costs on a per-pupil basis and what those trends have been like? Typically when we talk about funding, we talk about on a per-pupil basis, and yet I don't recall seeing things of that nature with respect to special education.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nauman. And Senator Hand, yes. The database that we prepared, that we've been working on over the summer, does have special education data in it. Going back to 2002, we can prepare it for your district. Senator Wergen approached me yesterday about getting her districts, or we can do a data run off of that would show over time. The one thing when you're doing calculations of special ed revenue per pupil is that we're averaging those revenues over all students in the district. So the cautionary note here is we're not averaging it over those students that are receiving just the special ed services. It's the special ed revenue divided by all students in the district.
Senator Hand.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Nauman, I appreciate that. And I guess what I'm trying to get at is, as we've seen the growth in anticipated spending in special education, for me it would be helpful to understand, does that represent dramatic growth in individual costs of special education students? Or, and I guess the way we typically get a handle on that is say, well, how many special ed people are being served and what are we paying to do that and what does that trend look like? And I think to me it would be helpful to have some sense of what that looks like as we decide what to go to do.
Yeah,
in the future.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Senator Hand, if you give me maybe a week or so, I'll visit with the department about that and try to unpack that a little. I think that relates materially to some of the conversation that you may be having next week with PS Minnesota. They have some thoughts about making adjustments to special ed, but other states don't fund exactly the way we do here with the two-year lag and the funding of salaries. Some states choose a weight. And they say, here's what we're going to pay. And some states believe that more accurately or allows the state to maintain a lid on the costs better. But there are arguments on both sides. And what I'll try to do is see if that we have a special ed count that we can divide the numbers by and allow you, at least on a district basis, to get some sense of it. Would that be where you're headed?
And Mr. Chairman, and Senator Nauman, I mean, Mr. Nauman, sorry. or maybe I demoted you to being a senator, I guess. I guess the question I'm trying to understand is that, and I've heard different things, and I don't know what the truth is, but that's why I think it would be helpful to have this, is we know that there are lots of special ed needs, and there are growth in some categories and not in others, and are we seeing a change in the people we're serving, the children we're serving, and are the needs more costly? And somehow to get an idea of how well we're doing in actually educating individual kids. And to look at the total numbers is great, but it doesn't really help me to understand. Does that mean we're spending a lot more per pupil or a lot less per pupil, or have the dynamics of this changed somewhat? And I think as we're looking at how to address this, it would be helpful to know where we need to focus.
I think, Senator Hand, that's certainly an area, I think, when we get into the budget, you know, that we can bring in the department and the people who are actually working in this area, that probably would be a real good area.
Good.
I know it's a very large disparity, and it's growing, at least from what I, in my visiting with districts, that's quite a costly area.
Mr. Chairman, before we proceed, I would appreciate some thoughts. Were these charts that we just went through helpful? Did they assist some of the questions that you had before?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Very good. Ms. McCoy.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to now go over some of the capital and facilities programs. These are the programs that fund the improvements to school buildings, the coding issues, and the buildings themselves. Health and safety revenue, debt service revenue, alternative facilities. There's some one-time energy assistance aid that the 2006 legislature established, deferred maintenance, telecommunications, and maximum effort. Again, from the spreadsheets that were handed out yesterday, these numbers are taken straight from there. The total spent in this fiscal year, 2007, was $41.8 million. Health and safety revenue is equalized. Health and safety revenue is for districts with coding issues mainly. It was established in 1988 to deal with asbestos issues or fire safety. Districts take each project is reviewed individually. Districts submit their project to the department, and the department decides if the project is going to be funded or not. It's a revenue stream that's kind of inconsistent, and so it's on a per project basis. Each health and safety project can't exceed $500,000 per site. Debt service revenue is a revenue stream to help districts deal with the cost, the debt associated with building a new school building. most of the costs associated with a new school building are repaid through local levy. The projects must be reviewed by the commissioner. This process is called a review and comment that you'll often hear about. This debt repayment is equalized on two levels, actually three if you think of it that way. The first 15% of the debt associated with the new school building or capital improvement is paid completely with local levy. After the 15%, the repayment, the revenue, is equalized on two tiers, $3,200 and $8,000. And then just a reminder, this is the aid levy split policy that Mr. Nauman was talking about yesterday and brought up a little today. The aid levy split, again, as the district's property wealth increases, the debt is repaid through local levy. The plot here shows just one line or one slope. But this program actually has three. It starts with up because the first 15% is paid with local levy, and then from 0% of the adjusted net tax capacity to 3,200, it's paid. It's equalized on one split, and then from 3,200 to 8,000, it's equalized on another split.
Ms. McCoy, on this particular levy, we also, I believe, last year or 2 years ago, tried to increase that inflation factor on this, because if you look at the numbers, the state's contribution has been going down each year instead of up. And the reason for that is that many of the districts' valuations are going up, and so the state's contribution goes down. Many districts that had buildings didn't realize that, or if they did, the voters didn't realize it. And so you passed a bond in your district, and that was kind of sold to the voters and a split, you know, state and local revenues. Then all of a sudden, pretty soon, it's all local revenues and no state revenues. And the reason being is that the valuations went up, and basically some districts were totally left to fund that project out of local property taxes. Yeah. So I think that was one that was we tried to adjust in the last education bill.
Mr. Chair, in the 2006 Senate bill, the 3,200 equalization was bumped up to 5,000 to deal with exactly what you were talking about, but it didn't pass in conference.
Okay. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to, Mr. McCoy, just to clarify, the local levy that is raised for capital projects in every district, is it fair to say that 100% of all local levy money is spent locally? Is that the truth? And so the aid that is being made up is coming out of general taxation dollars. Is that the correct way to look at this?
That's
Ms. McCray?
I'm going to let Mr. Nauman speak to this point a little more, but that's not exactly.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, just a question to your question. Are you speaking about just the capital side of this, or are you speaking about all local levies?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Nauman, I guess specifically about this levy, but.
Okay. With respect to just this specific one, debt service levies are raised locally and are used to pay back a debt that the district has previously agreed to take out. This services that debt. In a few select cases, when we get to the maximum effort loan program, those districts will raise revenue. They'll levy up to the maximum. Ms. McQuay will speak to this in more detail. And the money will service their debt, but it's a debt taken out by the state. So they will have to then take that levy, and unless they find a way to get around it, and we can talk about that, they will send the money to the state.
Ms. McCoy.
Okay. Mr. Chair, in the 1993 legislature, they passed alternative facilities bonding, which was meant to deal with health and safety issues for larger school districts that were having projects that were greater than the $500,000 limit set on health and safety. There are a couple of restrictions on the alternative facilities bonding program to establish the size of the project or the size of the school. For instance, there has to be 66 students per grade to qualify for alternative facilities bonding. The projects under alternative facilities have to be are the same projects that are eligible and ineligible under the health and safety program. So this program allows the districts to issue bonds for the health and safety improvements and deferred maintenance projects without voter approval. This levy is also equalized, but equalized in a different sense. The larger districts were initially allowed to receive state aid, a certain portion of state aid for their project. And the 2005 legislature established the deferred maintenance revenue, and this will be effective for fiscal year 2008. and it's available to those districts that still have the projects that are greater than the $500,000 not eligible under health and safety, but weren't meeting that big district eligibility for alternative facilities bonding. The revenue is calculated at $60 for adjusted marginal cost pupil unit, and then there's a downward adjustment in that $60 if your building is newer than 35 years old. The levy then is calculated at with an adjustment for the adjusted net tax capacity per adjusted marginal cost pupil unit for $5,900, which means that if your adjusted net tax capacity per AMCPU is over $5,900, the revenue is all levy. The district does not receive state aid. If the district decides to levy for less than what is actually permitted by the formula, then the state aid is reduced to a proportional amount.
Excuse me, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, how is the magical number of 5,900 chosen? Are those rates kind of based on how much money you project that's going to be spent, or is there some rational basis for choosing a number like 5,900?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, the 5,900 was established in much the same way as the other arbitrary numbers were established. The committee was allowed a certain amount of money to spend on deferred maintenance, and this number was backed into that way.
Ms. McQuay?
The maximum effort school aid is one last way that school districts can build a new school building that are not able to actually bond for the issue bonds for the school themselves. It's available to school districts. It's really meant for school districts who don't currently have the property tax base, but because of demographics will soon have that tax base. So instead of issuing bonds locally, the state will loan the money to the district, and the district then agrees to tax themselves at a statutorily defined maximum effort and pay back the state in that way over a 50-year period. And some in the beginning years, when they don't have that property tax-based wealth, the statutorily defined maximum effort still doesn't meet the total amount that the district needs to pay the state. So the state then makes up that. But over the course of the 50 years, it's meant to make up that amount of the loan. And after 50 years, if the debt is still not paid off, the debt is retired and the district doesn't have to pay it. Okay.
Sounds like a good idea.
Mr. Chairman and members, the idea here is that for when we originally established this program, it was intended for growing school districts that would be gaining tax base or anticipated to gain tax base over time. The practicality is that has not always been the use. In some cases, the maximum effort loan program has been used for school districts that don't have the tax base and probably won't ever have sufficient tax base to pay for a new school. And in that case, the 50-year limit really does come into apply. They pay the maximum effort for up to 50 years, and then the debt is retired, and the state has paid back the loan to the bondholders, but the district never does.
And also, you can pay that off before the 50 years. Because if you're levying the maximum and you have that growth in your district, and I'm trying to think of I don't know if it was Lakeville or one of the communities that was rapidly growing, actually I think paid it off much quicker than anticipated.
Mr. Chair and members, I didn't have the time to look into which districts because I was curious myself. The program was started in 1959, so I'm sure it was meant to deal with those. I think Lakeville is now probably a fifth ring suburb that was rapidly growing.
Senator Olson.
I don't know whether we're going to have some of those bills before us this year or not, but But I think that then the challenge for us is in the legislature is to determine the level of that need. You know, obviously, it's probably going to get paid back when you see that growth, but particularly when there is a potential for it not to happen. I think the districts do have to make a pretty strong case as why they are making an investment in a non-growing area in terms of the educational need of that area. So it does present some rather interesting cases, but it's a kind of a case-by-case thing that we are trying to resolve, and it rests with us to determine that.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe, Mr. Nauman, maybe you'd know, aren't there several districts that just simply don't even pay back the loan at all also? And there's really no repercussion for not paying anything back?
Mr. Chairman and members, Senator Wergen, I'm not sure that's entirely right. It's your definition of what is paying back at all. Red Lake, for example, has a maximum effort. They have one piece of property that is taxable. I think it's a store in one of the towns. The chairman can probably speak to this better than I because he used to represent this area. The maximum effort tax bill imposed on that one piece of property generates $2,000 a year. That's certainly not enough to meet the payment. And we're fully cognizant of the notion that unless something dramatically changes in the Red Lake School District to bring a lot of property online, which I don't think anyone is anticipating, that the maximum effort loans in the Red Lake School District are not going to generate enough to pay off the maximum effort loan.
Senator Rowland.
Did you say that we're waiting 50 years to give them time to pay that off? And it started in 1959, so are we just going to be bumping up against that 50 years for all the ones that started back then?
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, I think we'd both like Ms. McQuay and I would like the opportunity to go back and get the history of how this has played out. Logic would assume that you would be bumping into it, but my suspicion is that in the early years we were generating maximum effort loans at the state level for those growing districts. That was the original intent, and those districts did in fact grow and pay off the loans as the chairman indicated. It's only been in later years that this program has been used for districts that you may be suspicious about whether they would have the future tax growth to actually pay off the loan. So I don't think that we're close, but let us do a little digging on this one to come back with you some additional information.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd be curious, too, how the state bookkeeping has been handled on it so that has it already been considered as money that would be a gain if it came in, or will it be? Are we already planning on it coming in and have that in our budget? And if it doesn't come in, then that's a shortfall.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, generally when general bonds are issued, they're issued for less than 50 years, and so the maximum for school loans that were issued in 1959, for example, or in the early 60s, the school districts are still paying off the loan, but the bond by the state has been paid off. So how the state keeps those books, it's probably additional money to the.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Nauman, Ms. McQuay. You mentioned that this was intended to help, back when it was started, districts that were anticipated to grow and would be able to eventually repay the loan. Is that intention expressed in the statute in any way in terms of establishing the criteria of which districts would qualify? In other words, have we been doing things that may be in violation of the original intent but are not necessarily in violation of the statute itself by granting this program to districts that people really don't believe have any possible chance of actually repaying the loan? Is that something that is in the statute, or is that just more the sort of the legislative history that we were trying to accomplish at the time?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn,
Ms. McQuay.
Senate Counsel is looking that up, but I don't think I should speak to it because I can't recall.
I think I can shed some light on that. Not that I've been here that long, but the The legislature adopted the equalization, the capital equalization program, which really replaced most of the need for the maximum effort. And even in districts, small districts, almost every one of them uses that equalization program now, and it's the kind of the exception that actually uses the maximum effort. So I bet it's just a handful in the last few years that have even thought about using the maximum effort.
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Hand might want to speak a little bit more about this. There is, interestingly, a policy and purpose statement in advance of this section of law, and the language does speak generally about exceptional circumstances, but it doesn't uniquely say growing school district. It just speaks, I believe, Senator Hand, you've got the language, that's what it speaks to.
And I think over the life of that maximum effort legislation, it went from, I think it was 25 years, and then we bumped it up to, maybe it was 30 years, and we bumped it up to 50 years.
Mr. Chairman, 30 to 50 is my recollection.
And
Senator Hamm?
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Nauman, thank you for the, and it does have a policy and purpose statement, and you're right, it doesn't say specifically, it just says that most instances they will be able to provide the required funds, and there may be exceptional cases where temporarily the costs may exceed the burden. And so there is a sort of this implication that it was designed to do things on a temporary basis, and I guess to the extent that what you're saying, I guess, is that we haven't really taken advantage of this to deal with districts where there really is no expectation that the circumstance is temporary, but maybe more permanent. That was kind of my question. So,
Ms. McQuaid?
Mr. Chair and members, new to this committee this year is early education funding and lifelong learning, and that's what we'll be going into right now. It's also new to me. This, again, is from the spreadsheets in your packet. In fiscal year 2006, early education totaled $46.2 million, appropriated from the state. The first program I'm going to talk about is school readiness, which is meant for children aged 3 to kindergarten. The program is all state aid, and the programs are first approved by the commissioner. I believe every district in the state has a school readiness program, and the money going out to those districts is based on the total number of 4-year-olds in the district and also the level of poverty in the district. It's based 50-50 on each one of those elements. Early childhood family education is meant for children aged birth to kindergarten and their parents. The revenue generated for this program is $104 times the total number of 5-year-olds in the district. This program is an aid and levy program, and again, the aid is equal to the revenue minus the levy and is again reduced if the levy actual is less than the levy allowed.
Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. McQuay, I thought that last year we raised that to $112 in the 2006 legislative session.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Nauman.
And members, I believe that's correct. There are a couple of cases where we didn't get all the updates taken care of in this one, and that might be one of them. My recollection serves that there was a point in time prior to some of the budget-saving efforts that this was actually 120.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Nelman, it was at 120, and then with the 2003 cuts, it went to 104. And then in the 2006 session, we tried to get it back to 120, but we're successful at getting it to 112.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonnet, the department is nodding, so I think that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you for that correction. Senator Wergen?
Mr. Chair, it's just a piece of history, but I've really never understood, and it's really never been well explained, why we fund this program at $112 per 5-year-old student in a district as opposed to the student served. And if the purpose is getting the kids ready for school, why are we not, why is this incentive not geared towards those students that need the extra help instead of a flat fee per resident of the district? There's really no rationale between what the program is trying to achieve and the way we fund it.
Mr. Chairman and members, I've asked Karen Carlson from the Department of Education to join us. She's going to be better at some of these policy-related questions. Staff is just cutting into this issue.
All right, I'm now blocked. Where's that special ed revenue line? Mr. Chair and Senator Wergen, actually, the purpose of ECFE, Early Childhood Family Ed, is not to get kids ready for, well, the purpose is not to get them ready for school. That isn't the expressed purpose. The purpose is to provide parenting education to improve child development of the birth to five-year-olds. The purpose of the school readiness program, the first one that Ms. McQuay talked about, is to get the kids ready for school. The ECFE revenue based on every five-year-old in the district, it's a universal program, so that's what it was meant to reflect. All the five-year-olds and all the four-year-olds and all the three-year-olds and all, you know, can come to that program. So that was the intention of the formula when it was originated.
Senator Wergen?
I realize that, but there's a little bit of a perverse incentive here. If you're going to get X amount of dollars, whether you have a child in the program or not, where's the incentive to bring in the maximum number of children into a program? Are you not almost incentivized to have less children in the program and have more money?
Is there, Ms. Carlson, is there a connection between the 104 or 112 or 120 and the actual cost of the delivery of these programs per student?
Mr. Chair and Senator Wergen, no, there's no relationship from to the established per child, per resident amount to the cost of the service. And in addition, also the districts collect fees from the parents who do participate. So that gives them revenue from the participants. But
Senator Olson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Wergen, I think it's been remarkable how what an impact this program has and the acceptance that it has, despite of its irrational form of funding.
Senator Clark?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Carlson, could you talk a little bit about what the actual cost, though, kind of varies per district? Because my understanding is that is below the amount they're getting, is below what their actual costs are, which is why we see the slide, and that in some linkage with regard to the numbers of kids as it relates to dollars they see. Because I think Sarah Wergen's questions are certainly good ones. There doesn't seem to be a lot of connection there, but it does. My recollection is that it's not like they're getting more money than the service costs, nor that they're spending. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Clark, and actually it's difficult for us to determine the cost of the services because, I mean, we don't have districts report numbers of participants and you know, pretty rudimentary information like that, but we don't ask them to cost out their services. So we arrive, this is a terrifically sophisticated formula, we arrive at the cost per participant by taking the total expenditures, including the and revenue, including the fees that are collected, and divide it by the number of parents and children, because they're both considered participants. And that varies tremendously district by district. A statewide average amount is probably between $300 and $400 per participant. So if you kind of take the typical dyad of the parent with one child coming, you know, that's $800, $900 that the service is costing, if you will, and you know. And that relationship to the $112 is.
Senator Wergen?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question isn't because I have any qualms about the effectiveness of the program. I think the ECFE program has done some really good things. I see that in my district. I mean, I think we have some fantastic ECFE programs in my district, and I'm sure there are in all of ours. It's just that there's a part of me that likes to see some rational basis for funding something, and that's kind of what's missing here. It's not a lack of value for the program. It's excellent.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Carlson. Ms. McQuay?
Also under this committee's jurisdiction is community education and adult basic. And adult basic education. These are your basic community ed activities where the booklet comes out, and summer programs for elementary and secondary students. The community education revenue is calculated at $5.42 times the population of the district. And the district is also allowed to levy. There's a community education levy.
And one of the you're going to get into the adult basic. Good.
Also is adult basic education, and these are intended to serve the students over the age of 16 who are not attending high school, elementary or secondary school. This is the GED program mostly. And the states reimburse the districts for 100% of the cost, which is calculated by the contact hours. So this one's a little more. All right. I think that was it.
Go back to those last two slides, to some degree, I guess, all the last three areas that we dealt with, an interesting kind of question that I have is that the districts have the responsibility for, or the boards have the responsibility for those levels, for adult basic and community ed and in some cases the ECF or the early childhood. When you have so much pressure on the property taxes, for general education, you know, let's say K through 12 or whatever, I wonder what impact that has on things like, the ABE programs and the summer school programs and the adult basic programs, because it would seem like they would fall to kind of somewhat less than a priority. When they're levying, but do you get any feedback on that area or from the department?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that we're in a position to necessarily answer that question. It might be helpful when those organizations come before the committee to speak more directly with them about how the more recent budget years have affected some of their decisions. It's a reasonable assumption to make the suggestion that when dollars get tighter, discretionary dollars are going to be going to educating the core programs, and that some other programs may fall as lower priorities in a circumstance like that. But I don't think we can answer at this point whether that there are general trends that can speak to that.
And Mr. Chair, the difference too between the general education program and these other types of programs is these are allowed to charge fees, whereas in the general education program, a district can't charge a fee for it.
Well, the summer school programs, why aren't they necessarily under the general education?
The summer school. Is counted as, I believe, extended time. These summer programs that are offered in community education would be like the local softball teams.
All right.
So.
Thank you. Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'm trying to remember where the ESL, adult ESL programs fit in. Aren't they under ABE? Or is there a separate funding stream for the...
So.
And there's also... I don't know if you mentioned that, but... there's also... I know there's another factor that comes into the funding that has hit St. Paul particularly hard and some of the other communities that have lots of adult learners who, especially who are immigrants, who don't speak English or who want to get a GED so they can get a job. And because we have our literacy programs and GED programs and programs like that for adult learners have long waiting lists. And isn't there some kind of a growth factor or something that varies from district to district across the state? I'm trying to remember how that works.
I can do so.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, I think the answer to that question lies in two programs. I mean, you've got both Community Ed and ABE that you were talking about there. The growth factor that you're referring to has been recently reinstituted as of last year into the ABE program. I think it's a 3% growth factor. That also, at the same time that we turned off the special education growth factor, which we talked about earlier, was also turned off in 2003, but last year it was, as I mentioned, was reinstituted. I think that might be what you're thinking of.
And, well, Mr. Chair, I know there's, I know it's created some kind of differences between districts that have lots of people and those that don't. Maybe it's just based on whether we have more growth.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson,
we've been hit harder.
When a district charges a fee, it is mandatory that they have a sliding scale for that fee, and so this may generate different amounts of money for different districts, and why there's waiting lists in certain districts.
I don't think that's our issue.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, where does the I think it's in the general education area, but the technical kinds of funding. Where do you find those?
Mr. Chairman and members, we didn't get everything done. We got most of it done. If I can call your attention to the levy tracking sheet from the previous day, it's like this. Line 35, Mr. Chairman, is the career and technical levy. An unequalized levy, and because we were trying to focus your initial attention on those that had both aid and levy or just aid, that one was not included. You'll notice we've got several hundred lines of different miscellaneous levies, so we didn't include everything on here. The career and technical, I think, program is mostly funded off of that levy on line 35.
Is that just down a couple from the tree growth levy?
Mr. Chairman, that would be correct.
Mr. Chairman, in addition, the telecommunications access aid is funded under the capital, capital and facilities programs at $3.8 million for the fiscal years.
All right, Senator Roebling.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering, is the integration aid, is that involve a local levy or not?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, yes, it does. It's a statutory percentage. I think we're at I better check the percentage, but I think it's around 77% at this point.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Nauman and Koi and Anne Marie. It's still, I think we could go through this many times and keep learning, but you do have a lot of new information, and it's I know it gives us a good foundation, because there will be a lot of these issues like special education and many of these programs that we'll be working our way through from the perspective of the department, from the perspective of local districts, from the perspective of the budget and the stakeholders, yeah. And so I think this really gives us a kind of a good jumping off point. The next meeting we have, which will be next Tuesday morning, and that's at 8:30 Tuesday morning. Okay, that's PS Minnesota report, which has been in process for several years, initiated by Governor Pawlenty, and they'll have some new ideas on how we can kind of rearrange the funding and maybe do a better job. So that should be interesting. And then the governor will be giving his budget toward the end of this month, so that'll be within a week or two. Then we'll dive into that. So Yes, Senator Salzman.
You know, if you'd like to, just a little bit of background on PS Minnesota, you can go to psminnesota.org. And if you have a chance, it might be just helpful just to look at an overview. It might help you in your kind of questions for them. It's a very interesting proposal and worthy, I think, of our thought and during the next month.
Thank you. That's what it is. Okay. That sound that we're hearing, somebody just said that it's cell phones going off.
It is. Really?
Right.
Yeah.
Right, when your cell phones...
So if that continues, we probably would. I don't know. We're going to try to track it down, but it's irritating. And
yeah. I thought it was the sound.
Somebody,
Senator Wergen.
I know it's cell phones because yesterday when mine vibrated, that got really loud.
Okay.
So we'll have to turn them.
Mine aren't on vibrate.
Yeah, I don't think we. No, that's quite irritating, especially when you have people who are trying to give a presentation or something. So, well, thank you very, very much, members, and thank you for the good attendance. And look forward to seeing you all next Tuesday. Committee is adjourned.
Thank you.